KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
When I put together a mix, I'm thinking about creating an inviting atmosphere, really, for everybody.
While, you know, we're obviously very happy, there are many people who are still not at liberty to do this kind of thing. There are still hostages. There are still people who don't have their freedom inside Syria, and we wish them well.
You know, Washington is actually similar to a lot of states in that, you know, we have an underfunded public mental health system. I think that's pretty much endemic.
Today on Weekday, we're going to take a look at the underfunding of the mental health system. We're also going to talk about what has been happening with journalists covering the dangerous war in Syria, and hear from James Wetzel, who puts together the music mix that celebrates the water at Seattle Center Fountain. But we're going to start with new information from here. Yesterday, the Army said it will seek the death penalty for Staff Sergeant Robert Bales. Bales is accused of shooting and stabbing 16 Afghan men and women and children in an early morning attack on two villages in March. Bales' lawyer, John Henry Brown, called the decision totally irresponsible, had argued that his client should not face the death penalty because of his multiple deployments in the war zones. Gene Johnson has been covering the Bales case for the Associated Press. He joins us now. Gene Johnson, thank you for talking to us again.
Sure, happy to.
Was there any response, any kind of mood at Joint Base Lewis-McChord when the decision to seek the death penalty was announced by the Army?
No, not really. You know, the Army isn't really commenting beyond the statement that they put out, which simply said, yes, this case will be referred to a court-martial, as everyone expected, and that it will go forward as a death penalty case, which essentially just means that the panel, the jury, considering the charges against Sergeant Bales will have the option, if he is convicted, they'll have the option of voting for the death penalty.
Military rules require the president to personally sign off on a death sentence, but is the that comes after any possible conviction, is that right?
That's my understanding.
So when is the court-martial now set?
There's no date set, and everybody expects that it'll be years before it actually happened. I mean, if you take a look at the case of Nidal Hassan, who was charged in the massacre at Fort Hood back in 2009, he still hasn't faced court-martial yet. That's another potential death penalty case, and I don't think he even has a court-martial date set yet.
Is there any place chosen for where the court-martial will be held?
It will. It will be held at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, which is interesting. You know, there was a pretrial hearing last month for Staff Sergeant Bales, and it was really unusual because there were Afghan witnesses. Some of the villagers who were either victims of the shooting, who had been injured, or who had witnessed it. And they testified from a forward operating base down near Kandahar City, and they testified by video. And if the Army wants them to testify during the actual court-martial, they're going to have to fly them in person. There's no video testimony allowed.
Gene Johnson is covering the Bales hearings and now a court-martial that is going to include a death penalty portion for the Associated Press. Bales' wife has been speaking out regularly for her husband, and she says she wants to see, she's hoping to see, a fair trial. What's her concern?
Obviously, I think there's been a lot of publicity about this. I'm not sure what, you know, if there is anything to suggest that he's been treated unfairly by the military so far. But, you know, I mean, I think any time a relative is accused of something like this, you certainly want them to be treated fairly by the system.
She gets to visit with Bales on the weekends. Bales is in custody. He'll be in custody then until this trial is completed.
He will. Yeah, and she said in her statement yesterday that she and her kids have been visiting him every weekend at Lewis McChord, and they get to see him for a couple hours. And she says it's been nice to be able to see the kids interact with him.
Bales' lawyer, John Henry Brown, he has been raising questions about long deployments, multiple deployments. Are there signs from him whether he's going to keep that up as the main defense in his effort to spare his client's life?
It certainly is expected that he will. I mean, some of the military law lawyers and experts in the field who I've talked to say that certainly the fact that he was on his fourth deployment would be considered a potential mitigating factor. You know, as one of the military defense lawyers I was speaking with yesterday put it, he said, you know, Bales was not a mass murderer on his first deployment, and the Army needs to take some responsibility for what's happening with these soldiers on multiple deployments.
Is there a broader message that the Army is sending by taking this decision to seek the death penalty on Robert Bales?
Well, I think, you know, it's certainly in the Army's interest to show that it takes these sorts of cases very seriously. You know, it sends a message both to Americans, to soldiers and civilians alike, and also to the Afghans that this is something that the U.S. takes seriously, and that we need to do everything we can to prevent unnecessary casualties of civilians.
The last military executions were in 1961. When you talk to people, do they think this means there's a real chance there could be the first military execution in more than 50 years?
It's certainly a high hurdle for the Army in this case. I mean, you know, there are, you know, the fact that he was serving his fourth deployment is a strong mitigating circumstance, according to a lot of the lawyers that I've talked to. You know, there are five military members who are looking at death sentences right now, who have been sentenced to death. Their cases are in various states of appeal. It's sort of interesting. Only one of them occurred overseas. The rest were all stateside. The one that occurred overseas was the 2003 case of Sergeant Hassan Akbar, who was the soldier who threw a grenade at Camp Pennsylvania in Kuwait, and he killed two of his fellow soldiers and injured 14 others during the invasion of Iraq. So none of the current five were faced with charges of killings in war zones. So Bales would be the first.
Gene Johnson is a reporter for the Associated Press. The Army has decided to pursue death penalty for accused Afghan shooter Staff Sergeant Robert Bales. Gene Johnson is covering that trial. Gene Johnson, thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate you taking the time. This is Weekday. Syria is currently one of the world's deadliest places to be. As the fighting has continued between opposition groups and the government of Bashar al-Assad, 40,000 people are assumed dead. Journalists reporting on the story are being targeted also. 28 journalists have been killed there in Syria this year alone. Sharif Mansour is the Middle East and North Africa coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. I asked him what the particular reasons were for such a high death toll among journalists.
Certain factors. One of them is government blackout on journalistic coverage, which forced journalists to smuggle themselves into the country. And by doing so, they are exposed to more dangerous situations. So one of them is also the possibility of being abducted, the possibility of being in crossfire, and to be treated as pawn in the conflict that's been going on. So what we've seen is the number have increased dramatically the more the conflict gets heated up. Last year, for example, we only documented 2 killed cases in Syria. And this year, so far, we've documented 28. So the more the government makes its tactics of preventing journalists from getting into the country legally and from having access to information, the more they are exposed. Because this is their job, they will find ways to do it, and unfortunately it's going to be the expense at the expense of their lives and their safety.
Why is the Assad government more more determined to keep a clampdown on information? Other countries have similar revolutions, but it seems like sometimes the government welcomes certain voices.
The fact is there are numerous information about human rights attack, widespread attacks that takes place mainly from the government side, but also from the opposition side. And I think the Syrian government tactics is not new. Syria has been always an oppressive government. They tried for so long to be one of the top most censored countries in the world. We are ranking them right now as number 3 after Eritrea and North Korea. And over the years, they have systematically cracked down on dissent. The most recent development was the conflict between the Syrian government and the opposition only heightens and increases the number of victims and fatalities. But this has been consistent with Syria overall. It's not a free country. What we're seeing is that there are more tactics used, not just by targeting journalists with assassination, but also imprisoned journalists. We've seen that the number has been growing consistently since the revolution. Last year, 2011, we investigated and documented 8 cases. This year, we have 15. Abduction, for example, in 2012, this year, we have already 15 cases of abduction. We believe the government have still some of those people under custody. And even though 8 were released, there are still people who are considered missing, including 2 believed dead.
You know, we saw a high-profile abduction and then escape with NBC's Richard Engel, but when you look at the list, there are a number of Middle Eastern journalists working as freelancers or working for small organizations that, as you say, have been killed, have been abducted. 28 journalists have been killed in Syria this year so far. 67 worldwide have been killed. The rebels seem to have a more positive relationship with journalists. Why is that? And are journalists mostly endangered from government forces in Syria, or are also rebel forces attacking journalists?
Increasingly and most recently, this has been the case that the rebels and the opposition has targeted journalists. As we see, they've mainly focused on local government, a local Syrian government journalist, and they have conducted 2 explosions in 2 TV stations that affiliated with the government. And some of the captivity situations and abductions that we've recorded also includes allegedly some rebel members and Syrian opposition. We see that overall, yes, the Syrian government has predominantly conducted the most violations and attacks on targeting for journalists, but we are alarmed that, to see that the opposition itself is engaging in the same tactic.
Sharif Mansour is the Middle East and North Africa coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. 28 journalists have been killed reporting from Syria this year alone. It's a very dangerous place for reporters, civilians as well, of course. Justin Vella is an Istanbul-based freelance journalist who's reported from Syria over the past year. His articles have appeared in The Independent, The Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, other publications. He joins us on the phone. Justin, thank you for talking to us.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. But where have you reported from in Syria over this past year and around the region?
Well, since June 2011, I've mostly reported from northern Syria and the Turkish border area with the country. This is the areas of Idlib province and the Aleppo countryside and Aleppo city.
You also have been into the city of Aleppo, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I was last there in August. It's an extremely dangerous situation that continues to deteriorate, both in terms of safety for journalists and then, you know, more importantly, for the people that live there. It's increasingly dangerous all the time.
You're moving into a dangerous situation when you do reporting. Are you, as Sharif Mansour was telling us, are you smuggling yourself across the border?
You know, the first two times I reported inside of Syria, I did smuggle myself across the border. The first time, this was in June 2011, and I went with a group of refugees who had come into Turkey to pick up bread and water, and then were going back to Syria to give the supplies to their families. And I just kind of walked with them over over the border through some forests and hills for a couple of hours and entered that way. The next time I did something similar. But recently the Turkish border has been taken over. I should say the Syrian border checkpoints have been taken over by the rebels. And Turkey has allowed journalists to enter Syria through the official border crossings. So I've actually been able to go across more recently by going through a real border post and getting stamped by the rebels. They have signs that say, "Welcome to Free Syria," and their flags flying at these border checkpoints. You know, signs that these are the first signs of the new Syria that's emerging.
Justin Vella is a freelance journalist and an author. He is a graduate of Evergreen and is talking to us from San Francisco. He's based in Turkey in Istanbul. Well, how dangerous does it feel for you as a reporter to try to do work either in Free Syria or in disputed Syria?
It's incredibly dangerous. It's it's almost kind of it's blinding in some way, because the people that you go to report on are in such a dire situation, and you want to go and, you know, tell the world what has happened to them. And the country is incredibly beautiful. And so there are many, you know, reasons to go and feel almost comfortable, and people welcome you when you get there. But, you know, very quickly you realize that it's one of the most dangerous situations in the world, whether it's for a journalist coming from another country, and more importantly for the people that live there. At any minute, you will see a regime plane just appear out of nowhere and bomb an area, or, you know, fire machine guns at cars driving along the road. There's a lot of random sniper fire in towns, and there's a lot of random shelling from great distances. So you never know when something explosive is going to fall on you, essentially, or when a jet will appear and try to machine gun where you are.
You know, you've covered conflict. You've been in other parts of the world. Does it seem that in this case, though, journalists are being targeted specifically either by the regime or perhaps by rebel groups?
The regime is definitely targeting journalists, and that's been their policy from the very beginning. In Homs, the city, the southern city of Homs, you saw several journalists killed in what was an assassination by the Syrian government last February. As far as the rebels go, at first, most of the rebels were extremely welcoming to international journalists because they really wanted to get their side of the story told. They really wanted the international community to see what was happening inside of Syria. And as you have seen such a lack of response from the international community, you've seen the mood of the rebels turn against the Western journalists in particular that have come into the country more recently. And it's become increasingly dangerous for Western journalists to work inside of Syria.
You know, the most recent journalist listed as killed on the Committee to Protect Journalists page was killed December 4th, Naji Assad. He is said he was sniper shot him, it says, an editor for the state-run daily paper, Tishreen, backing up what Sharif Mansour said about that the rebels are now targeting government journalists as well. But you're saying that the rebels may also not be too happy with Western journalists. Does that mean they're targeting them or not cooperating with them? What are you seeing?
I think that there are some. What you have to remember is that when we talk about the Syrian rebel groups,
right,
these are a very loose collection of, like, loosely organized collection of different small bands, different units that operate largely independently of each other. So you might find some people that just don't want to take the time to, you know, once again plead to the national community through Western journalists that they need a no-fly zone or a humanitarian and more humanitarian aid, where they need weapons, because they don't want to take the time to do that because there's been no response or minimal response, and they're busy doing other things. And then there's also groups that are actively targeting Western journalists, perhaps because these are groups that are more extreme in terms of, you know, they might be Islamist groups, they might have more kind of criminal tendencies. Western journalists are extremely valuable, and they may think, okay, well, here's an opportunity for us to demand ransom. And
as we saw with the Richard Engel case, right? That seemed to be what was happening with Richard Engel, right?
I think that Richard Engel's case was very complicated, and I think that he was at least initially captured by a criminal group. But every case seems to vary. You have some groups that are just, maybe they're largely composed of foreign fighters, and they see especially American journalists as some kind of enemy, perhaps as a Western agent of some kind, and maybe you want to extract some kind of revenge for Western actions in throughout the Middle East, you know, whether it's Iraq or, you know, what has happened in Afghanistan as well.
Justin, I interrupted you, I'm sorry, but let me ask you, I just want to say Justin Vella is author of BA, Adventures in Education, Journalism, and Current Events. He's been reporting from the Turkish-Syria border and inside Syria as a freelancer. Been published in The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic. You're not there now, but it must be frightening. Are you going back to Syria to report again?
Yes, I'm definitely going to go back. There's a lot of reasons to go back, and there's a lot of reasons that international journalists need to be inside of Syria despite the dangers. I think that Syria is a conflict that many people in the United States have felt a great distance from and have wanted to kind of avoid thinking about, because they don't want to see the United States involved in another war in the Middle East after what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I don't think people really understand how central Syria is to I think, not only the future of the Middle East, but the future of security throughout the region and, you know, Europe and, indeed, even the United States and its allies. So it's also a conflict that has been very poorly understood from the beginning because of limitations of imposed on Western journalists by the regime. Journalists have not been able to report freely, and then also it's been extremely dangerous to report in Syria.
All right, Justin, I look forward to reading more of your work, and I appreciate you talking to us. Stay safe. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Justin Vella's book is BA, Adventures in Education, Journalism, Current Events. You can find a link to his website at kuow.org.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at how the media stigmatizes mental illness and how they often conflate mental illness and violence. That's coming up next. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Earth Justice, a nonprofit law firm that believes a healthy environment is a fundamental right, working to protect the waters of Puget Sound and the native salmon and orca that live there. Earth Justice. The Earth needs a good lawyer.
Well, I did hear of one girl who had 156 proposals of marriage and a present from a baker of a lemon meringue pie.
For 35 years, the Miss Subways contest was part of New York life.
Well, it was only 2 months, but I was a star.
Miss Subways, later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story and much more today from 3 until 6:30. We have clouds and rain, 44 degrees in the U District. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of today, the high in the mid-40s. It's going to be cloudy tonight with a chance of showers, the low in the mid-30s.
At his press conference yesterday, President Obama announced a commission that will propose new approaches for gun control and mental health care in this country. In partnership with the University of Washington's Communication Department, Dr. Jennifer Stuber leads a statewide coalition trying to promote accurate media portrayals of mental health.
It arose, I would say, 3 years ago. And our state, Washington State, received funding from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration to try to transform its mental health system. And one of the things that our state has been focused on is on improving media portrayals as one of the ways in which we address stigma and negative public attitudes about mental illness.
What do you think stigma is doing today? Is it worse? Is it better? I mean, how has it changed in terms of people then seeking help and knowing that mental illness means there could be recovery?
Well, the research on that is quite interesting and a little bit mixed. The first piece is that we actually have shown that public attitudes over time towards mental illness are predominantly negative, and that actually the stereotype about dangerousness and violence and mental illness is actually increasing and not decreasing, despite the research evidence to the contrary. But when you actually ask the public a direct question about will they be more likely to seek services, or do they think that the treatment's available, like people's attitudes over time in that regard, and when they're asked a very direct question about would they seek services, the attitudes seem to be improving in that way, but they're not improving when it comes to the stereotypes about mental illness.
What's the timeline for that decrease or that rise in the stigma? Is that over the last
50 years?
Over the last 50 years.
We've been looking at public attitude surveys over the last 50 years.
So is there any link between the public attitude surveys that you've done and the rise in the predominance of the sensational reporting you get with
we haven't been able to make that kind of direct linkage, but that's the belief, is that the, you know, the public attitudes are getting more negative, and in large part because the media portrayals, both news media, entertainment media, are also becoming more negative and more sensational.
Would you think that if the media told the health recovery stories, let's just pretend, on an equal basis with the tragedies that are then linked to mental illness, and we would have a shift? Or is it sort of human nature to glom onto the negative and create a story around it?
I personally do think we would have a shift. I mean, right now what we basically see is that about 50% of the stories in news media are of the negative stereotypical type. Another 25 to 30% are about treatment system issues, treatment, mental health system issues, some more
where
policy.
It's broken, though.
Right. It's where it's broken. Exactly. And then we've got about literally like less than 10% of stories that are about focus on recovery and treatment. And I get it, that that's not the kind of thing that the news wants to cover, because what's newsworthy about that? In reality, recovery happens all the time. So what's newsworthy about that? But I do think we do have an obligation, as news media, have an obligation to present a much more balanced picture of mental health and mental illness.
Given this story and how this story is unfolding, the Sandy Hook story, and as we do note, there are these two narratives that are emerging. One is, do we need more gun control? The other is, well, I said there's three. Should we somehow figure out a way to secure our schools? And then the third one is, do we need to address mental health funding or treatment? What would be an educational step? What stories would you like to hear now coming out of the press?
Well, you know, in our work as a coalition, one thing that we have actually found is that in very sad, tragic incidents like the one in Newtown, Connecticut, actually become an opportunity for learning. So one, you know, I showed up to this interview today not because I really wanted to be on the radio, but because I wanted to meet you and to make a relationship and
right.
to provide
these are the triggers.
Right, exactly.
To use an unfortunate metaphor.
Exactly. But then, you know, I think it is an important, for a news organization to sit down and say to itself, like, look, you know, there is some very negative coverage that's coming out about mental health and mental illness. Maybe we should be looking for a recovery story. You know, maybe we should look for finding a young person who's, because I know it's all about the stories, right? But finding a young person who's actually, you know, successfully turned themselves around, you know, in the face of, you know, major adversity, you know, who might have been on a similar path. Like, I think this is the opportunity to kind of try to portray a more balanced approach to these issues.
So before we started, I asked you if you had any children. Mm-hmm. You said you had two. So you have a 3-year-old.
I have a 3-year-old and a 7-year-old.
And the 3-year-old, you're not having a conversation about this at all with?
No.
Because it wouldn't help, if it even made some sense. It wouldn't help.
No, I think it would just be extremely scary.
And school would become a scary place.
Yes.
But how about the 7-year-old?
Well, my 7-year-old, I'm taking a more temperate approach. I'm kind of watching and looking. And seeing what he's hearing about it. Seven is, we've actually had some trauma and death and tragedy in our family, and so I'm particularly cautious about this. But I think definitely, I haven't brought it up with him directly, but if I hear that he knows anything about it, I plan to have a very direct conversation with him about it and allow him to ask the questions and give him very honest answers. One thing I will say as a parent who has the research interest that I have is that I'm very vigilant about the kinds of things that I allow him to watch on television. I limit his media exposure to obviously exposure to violence on television, video games. And I'm also really looking into what my kids are reading in children's books, because a lot of the stereotypes about mental illness emerge in those very, very early children's books. And so I'm very vigilant about that, making sure that he has an understanding of those stereotypes and context.
So I understand that you have the data about the stereotypes and how it affects people negatively. Is there enough data that you've looked at that warrants limiting exposure to violence in media for young people?
So this isn't my area of expertise in research, but as a parent, you know, I've done my job looking into this, and absolutely there's some very strong evidence that links, you know, exposure to violence in media to to children's perceptions about violence. And so we don't really understand the ways in which this could, you know, overlap with, you know, issues around mental illness where you might have, you know, symptoms that, you know, lead to aggression or impulsivity. Does it also intersects with substance abuse, you know, which is self-medicating for issues in one's past or trauma that one's experienced. So, you know, we don't really have good data. You know, I think in a healthy child, you know, media exposure to violence is still not a great thing because it desensitizes you to violence. It makes
that we know it, that exactly, data we know
exactly, but we don't really have great data on how it intersects when you've got a child who's experiencing either an organic, you know, biologically based mental disorder, or is experiencing, you know, a life of trauma.
So, just sort of
exposure.
A last question about this, or last way to look at this, since you're working on the statewide coalition, got funded. This is to promote the perceptions of mental health and portrayals in the media. But you're also you're part of a larger question of how the state is treating those with mental health questions. How is the state doing? Where are the holes that you have seen? Is that also not part of your expertise?
I'm happy because I actually teach a course on mental health policy at the University of Washington. I think you know, Washington is actually similar to a lot of states in that, you know, we have an underfunded public mental health system. I think that's pretty much endemic across the country. I think that we've got, you know, pockets of innovation. You know, I think that we've got some interesting things happening with the Affordable Care Act.
Because it brings mental health
into
funding.
It brings more people. First off, it insures more people, and it also brings about the opportunity to do better integration of, you know, health issues with mental health issues with substance abuse disorder issues. So I think we have some really big opportunities here. But I definitely think that the cuts to the budgets and the legislature over the last few years, while mental health has been relatively well protected because we have a pretty well-educated legislature about this issue, we still, you know, have a long ways to go in terms of actually providing, you know, prevention, you know, at early ages in all the different places where you could identify kids who are having difficulties, and then actually providing services. I mean, there's a lot of people who have really fallen who can't even access care within the public-funded mental health system. And then you've also got people who are getting private insurance who aren't getting adequate care. You know, we have a long way to go in terms of integrating, you know, evidence-based practices into treatment.
Because yet we have the evidence that we know as a society now which treatments are working for even those with the most severe problems.
Absolutely. We have evidence for treatments that are working for people with even the most severe problems. We just don't routinely provide those evidence-based treatments. We have a long way to go in that regard.
Now, I was struck by one other thing I learned this week, which is that the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction has a school safety coordinator, and among what they're charged with is putting together a team in every school or in every district that can do individual assessments of students, mental health assessments among them, so that they can identify and get services to students who may be in need.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that sounds like an awful lot of work and an awful lot of people involved. And the person in charge of it basically said, yeah, like probably, and we don't have quite the funding we need to do something like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. So some of the school-based health centers, you know, so we have some pockets of innovation there, but I know that it's been very challenging to kind of get them up and running, you know, in the way that they need to be, you know, in schools across the state.
All right. So leave me with what you think the consumer has to, the consumer as editor has to do when these stories arise and these questions arise about the mental health of a person involved in something, and then more broadly, when any story comes to you about where mental health or mental illness is part of the story?
Well, I think it's just not jumping to the conclusion. Like even if the journalist is making that mistake, or the person the journalist is interviewing is making that mistake of jumping to the conclusion that, you know, the simple, overly simplistic conclusion that mental illness causes violence, which it does not. And understanding that it's really about the broader context of the person's life, and that can play a role in violence. And so
ask ourselves the other questions.
Ask ourselves
and maybe
the other
get
questions
the press
that
to do it as well.
Exactly. Ask ourselves the other questions that are really, really important, and not just jumping to conclusions. And knowing that the vast majority of people who have a mental illness are never involved in violence, and knowing that we're all vulnerable to mental illness in our lives. And so when we make that equate mental illness with violence, we're really, you know, creating a larger set of societal problems. And actually contributing to the issues around not treating mental health, ironically, because we're creating the stereotypes, we're creating the stigma.
Yeah, and the a sense of that there's no way out. You're forlorn. You can't really deal with it.
You're not, and you're contributing to the social isolation that I think is really a big part of these events as well. That individuals who engage in these kinds of violent mass killings are very much on the outside, socially excluded, socially isolated, because they were just showing signs that they were different, that they were not like everybody else.
Dr. Jennifer Stuber is assistant professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Washington. She leads a statewide coalition designed to promote accurate media portrayals of mental health. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's 9:46. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. For some, it's about family. For others, it's about faith. And for some, it's just about food and drink. So what do the holidays mean to you? KUOW's David Hyde takes your phone calls at 12:40 today, and we welcome your thoughts right now at our feedback line, 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663.
Support for KUOW comes from Unity College, an environmental college located in Maine and proud to divest from investments in fossil fuels. More information at unity.edu. Unity, America's environmental college.
Next time on The Takeaway, what's next for NATO?
As an alliance, we have no intention to intervene militarily in Syria.
NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
That story and much more this afternoon at 1 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from the International Rescue Committee, committed to leading the way from harm to home for millions threatened and uprooted by war, disaster, and persecution in the U.S. and around the world. More at rescue.org.
Happy holiday. Happy holiday. While the merry bells keep ringing, may your every wish come true. Happy holiday, happy holiday.
That's Der Bingle singing Happy Holidays from the soundtrack to the film Holiday Inn. Now, yesterday, Robert Horton and I were talking about great holiday movies, and we did, as we often do, rake Holiday Inn over the coals a bit.
You have a hotel that's only open on holidays. I don't see the business model. I don't see it working out.
It's just not working.
No.
And as White Christmas has superseded a Holiday Inn, I think.
Yeah,
perhaps you are proven right.
I don't know. Maybe Fred Astaire and Bing Crosby still have that place out there somewhere.
Now, Amanda Wild, host of Swing Years and Beyond, an expert in the film and music of that era, offers a rebuttal.
Well, thanks, Steve. First of all, thanks for having me. Big fan of the show.
Big fan. First time listener.
Yeah,
first time caller.
Long
time listener.
Well, you know, I hear you guys malign Holiday Inn every single year, and I think it's just a wound I got one year when I just seen the movie, and then every year you reopen that for me. So thanks for giving me the chance to disagree with your maligning that great movie, which I think what may be happening is that you and Robert are dazzled by the technicolor of White Christmas.
It could well be.
Holiday
Inn looks good
in black and white, and even though there's great music in White Christmas, I think we could all fully agree it's a weaker story. And Holiday Inn
is the stronger story.
I think Holiday Inn is the stronger story.
Stronger music and...
And it won more than one Academy Award. I think it's an intriguing concept. I think Robert Horton contends that such an inn wouldn't work, and I think that's totally misguided. You know, and I don't think he's qualified to talk about it. He's a film critic, not a hotelier.
He has not run a hotel. That is true. Why do you think?
Furthermore, I guess he hasn't noticed that there's a whole, one of the largest hotel chains is called Holiday Inn. It's named after that song and that movie.
Now, I did not know that it had won Academy Awards.
Yes, including the song White Christmas. And let's remember, there'd be no White Christmas movie without White Christmas, the song from the movie Holiday Inn. White Christmas won that Academy Award for that year. So,
are you really telling me, though, that you think people would just go to an inn that was open for Valentine's Day, Washington's birthday?
I'm just saying, Holiday Inn franchise, one of the largest chains in the country. Very successful for over 50 years.
Now, you are going to be playing a lot of your swing music
right. This
Saturday night for your special Christmas show, right?
So, there's been this tradition since before I took over the program, because it's the longest running radio program in Seattle. So it's almost 50 years old.
Wow.
This is my 10th year hosting the Christmas show and the program itself. And so
on the Swingers and Beyond.
After 10 years of doing this particular show, I can safely say you will hear songs on the Swing Years, versions of songs you've never heard before on the program, and that no song will be repeated twice unless you want to hear, unless you count that first song that was ever played in space. That versions of that song will hear
many times. All right. One of the things you've noticed, so happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Irving Berlin. Right. Written by Irving Berlin.
White Christmas.
White Christmas. Irving Berlin. You have discovered that who has given us our modern sensibility of what Christmas is in America?
Well, we were talking about this yesterday, and I was just saying, you know, Jews invented our concept of the modern Christmas through music of the 1940s. So White Christmas, I'll Be Home for Christmas. And this next tune, which was written by two Jewish people and sung by one of the composers.
Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny little tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh.
So there's a little Mel Torme. Amanda?
Oh.
All right. Holiday Inn. So you're saying we should watch Holiday Inn. Think about how the Jews have helped us appreciate the Christmas season.
Well,
what other movies?
I just want to name some other songs. Johnny Marks wrote Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Holly Jolly Christmas and Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree. Silver Bells, written by Jews, Sleigh Ride, half-Jewish song. So you asked me yesterday, don't you play Hanukkah songs? And I get asked that a lot. And I say, all the Jewish people were writing these holiday songs, creating Christmas. And we also work on Christmas for you, so thank you very much. Other suggestions for movies, Bachelor Mother with Ginger Rogers and a young David Niven, very sweet movie. Remember the Night with Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray. The Lemon Drop Kid, which introduced the song Silver Bells with Bob Hope and a cast of great character actors. So I'm sure you would love that. And one movie we always forget and should always remember, Meet Me in St. Louis.
That's a Christmas movie?
It has Christmas in it. It's got all the seasons in it. But it introduced Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Worth
seeing. Wow. Yeah. And Lemon Drop Kid is a Christmas scene?
Oh, you got to see it.
I've seen it like four times.
Watch it again.
There's no brain left. All right. So in honor of the fact, just that you mentioned it, I just wanted to go out with, since you don't have any Hanukkah music for a Christmas show Saturday night
no
from 7 to
Hanukkah
12.
Music, no good. I don't think we're going to hear any good Hanukkah music now. Either.
Maybe. But here's you want to say something real quick about Mickey Katz, who I want to listen to, little Mickey Katz going out.
Just what he lacked in taste, he made up for in sheer volume of recordings.
Yeah, no
he was
kidding.
Prolific.
The man was prolific. All right, a little Mickey Katz go out.
Horse belt.
Amanda Wild, 7 to 12, Christmas show on Saturday night. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Little Mickey Katz, Marcy Silman.
Freilach.
We're just, all the Jews are celebrating Christmas this year.
It's festive time of year. Actually, I'm celebrating the solstice one day ahead. Winter solstice, my favorite holiday.
Oh, that is fine.
Love it. Well, you know, for the winter holidays, you've been to Seattle Center. There's a fountain there.
I was there last week listening to the music.
James Wetzel, who programs the music, does seasonal mixes. And you may recall that I went to visit him in, I think, late June. And he had just put in the new summer mix. And it was a beautiful day. Kids were romping around in the fountain. And I thought, who's this guy? And so here he is.
My name is James Wetzel. And I do the music programming for the Seattle Center and International Fountain.
How long have you had this job?
Since 2000.
Yeah. I had no idea it was that long.
Yeah, yeah. I've kept it secret for a long time.
I think of this as the fountain DJ job.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's actually what I usually say. I'm the DJ for the fountain. I don't pick everything in it. There's some things that it shoots off the giant jets to that I didn't choose. But I did one of those in 2006, and I do all the stuff when it's not shooting off the giant jets. It's my choices.
So how'd you get this job?
I knew the person who did it before me. And they asked me to do it. I knew them from music industry work. I was a musician and a performer, and, you know, that's so they asked me about it. They thought I had eclectic tastes, I might be good for it, and worked out. So
it's a little, I said DJ, but this isn't like being a DJ in a club where you've got a select clientele. Before I turned on the microphone, you said it's a public space, and right now there's like a few dozen kids shrieking, there's parents, there's tourists, it happens to be sunny, which is rare. So first of all, who's your audience, and then what are you thinking about when you put together a mix?
You know, when I put together a mix, I'm thinking about creating an inviting atmosphere, really, for everybody. So for people who are from Seattle, for people who are just visiting, for kids, definitely, and for adults. So I try to have a little something there for everyone. When it's warmer, like now, I tend to put a little bit more higher energy music because I know kids love to come and play around. So I put a little bit more higher energy music in there.
Are there standards? Sometimes I've heard classical music in here.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, for instance, this mix has everything from like some early salsa from 1957 to some electronic music from 2011. So everything from glitch hop to old salsa to funk from the 70s to... I have some Seattle ska by a band called The Notables in here. I always have some Seattle-based music in there. I try to get as much local as I can.
What's the duration of the mix itself?
It's interesting. We recently changed the system. It used to be once a week we'd change it, but we were operating on CDs, which is obviously a smaller amount of music. So now we have a new disc system where I can put up to 2.5 hours, maybe 3 hours of music. So we're changing it about every 2 weeks. Sometimes if there's a special event, it could change at a snap or more often, but generally every 2 weeks now.
Do you sneak in favorites in particular every time you change?
You know, I mean, I try to change it up as much as I can, but I do have, since I've done it for so long, I kind of have a vast library of stuff. And so, for instance, this mix, I had, you know, like 25 new tracks that I wanted to work in, but 5 of them didn't make the cut, and I ended up with 30 tracks in this mix. And so I drew from some of my older stuff that I haven't played in a while. Every year, kind of before Bumbershoot, I do what I call the Bertha Landis playlist, and so it's all local music. It's all just featured, all local stuff.
That's a little music that James Wetzel put together. He is the guy who has the fun job of putting the music mix together down at Seattle Center. He talked to Marcy Silman last summer. We wanted to play that again to remind you that the winter music mix, the holiday music mix at the Seattle Center Fountain is up. And when it's not storming, I'm sure you could have a good time listening to that music down at the Seattle Center. Dow Constantine's coming up. Our radio retrospective takes a look at Christmas. Sarah Dickerman has a restaurant recommendation. There's much more still ahead on Weekday on 94.9 KUOW Seattle.
It's a minute before 10. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from the Willows Inn on Lummi Island, serving a menu of locally fished, foraged, and farmed ingredients prepared by Chef Blaine Wetzel, now booking waterfront retreats and catered holiday events. More information and online gift certificates at Willow.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.